The Journal to Stella by Jonathan Swift. With preface, introduction and notes by George A. Aitken. Numbers thus, 5, refer to the notes at the end, which are arranged by introduction, or by letter number. Preface, the history of the publication of the Journal to Stella is somewhat curious. On Swift's death, 25 of the letters, forming the closing portion of the series, fell into the hands of Dr. Lyon, a clergyman who had been in charge of Swift for some years. The letters passed to a man named Wilkes, who sold them for publication. They accordingly appeared in 1766 in the 10th volume of Dr. Hawksworth's quarto edition of Swift's works. But the editor made many changes in the text, including a suppression of most of the idle language. The publishers, however, fortunately for us, were public-spirited enough to give the manuscripts, with one exception, to the British Museum, where, after many years, they were examined by John Forster, who printed in his unfinished Life of Swift numerous passages from the originals, showing the manner in which the text had been tampered with by Hawksworth. Swift himself too, in his later years, obliterated many words and sentences in the letters, and Forster was able to restore not a few of these omissions. His zeal, however, sometimes led him to make guesses at words which are quite undecipherable. Besides Forster's work, I have had the benefit of the careful collation made by Mr. Ryland for his edition of 1897. Where these authorities differ, I have usually found myself in agreement with Mr. Ryland, but I have felt justified in accepting some of Forster's readings which were rejected by him as uncertain. And the examination of the manuscripts has enabled me to make some additions and corrections of my own. Swift's writing is extremely small, and abounds in abbreviations. The difficulty of arriving at the true reading is therefore considerable, apart from the erasures. The remainder of the journal, consisting of the first 40 letters, was published in 1768 by Dean Swift, Dr. Swift's second cousin. These letters had been given to Mrs. Whiteway in 1788, and by her to her son-in-law, Dean Swift. The originals have been lost, with the exception of the first, which, by some accident, is in the British Museum, but it is evident that Dean Swift took even greater liberties with the text than Hawksworth. He substituted for P.T. the word Tella, a name which Swift seems not to have used until some years later. He adopted the name Risto for Swift, and in other ways tried to give a greater literary finish to the letters. The whole of the correspondence was first brought together under the title of the Ornal to Stella in Sheridan's edition of 1784. Previous editions of the journal have been but slightly annotated. Swift's letters abound with allusions to people of all classes with whom he came in contact in London, and to others known to Esther Johnson in Ireland, and a large proportion of these persons have been passed over in discreet silence by Sir Walter Scott and others. The task of the annotator has, of course, been made easier of late years by the publication of contemporary journals and letters, and of useful works of reference dealing with Parliament, the Army, the Church, the Civil Service, and the like, besides the invaluable Dictionary of National Biography. I have also been assisted by a collection of MS. notes kindly placed at my disposal by Mr. Thomas Seccombe. I have aimed at brevity and relevance, but it is hoped that the reader will find all the information that is necessary. Here and there a name has baffled research, but I have been able to give definite particulars of a very large number of people, noblemen and ladies in society in London or Dublin, members of Parliament, doctors, clergymen, government officials, and others who have hitherto been but names to the reader of the journal. I have corrected a good many errors in the older notes, but in dealing with so large a number of persons, some of whom it is difficult to identify, I cannot hope that I myself have escaped pitfalls. G.A. Introduction. When Swift began to write the letters known as the Journal to Stella, he was 42 years of age, and Esther Johnson 29. Perhaps the most useful introduction to the correspondence will be a brief setting forth of what is known of their friendship from Stella's childhood, the more especially as the question has been obscured by many assertions and theories resting on a very slender basis of fact. Jonathan Swift, born in 1667 after his father's death, was educated by his uncle Godwin, and after a not very successful career at Trinity College, Dublin, went to stay with his mother, Abigail Eric, at Leicester. Mrs. Swift feared that her son would fall in love with a girl named Betty Jones, but, as Swift told a friend, he had had experience enough not to think of marriage till I settle my fortune in the world, which I am sure will not be in some years. And even then, I am so hard to please that I suppose I shall put it off to the other world. Soon afterwards an opening for Swift presented itself. Sir William Temple, now living in retirement at Moor Park, near Farnham, had been, like his father, master of the Irish Rolls, and had thus become acquainted with Swift's uncle Godwin. Moreover, Lady Temple was related to Mrs. Swift, as Lord Orrery tells us. Thanks to these facts, the application to Sir William Temple was successful, and Swift went to live at Moor Park before the end of 1689. There he read to Temple, wrote for him, and kept his accounts, and growing into confidence with his employer, was often trusted with matters of great importance. The story afterwards improved upon by Lord Macaulay that Swift received only £20 and his board, and was not allowed to sit at table with his master, is wholly untrustworthy. Within 3 years of their first intercourse, Temple had introduced his secretary to William III, and sent him to London, to urge the king to consent to a bill for triennial parliaments. When Swift took up his residence at Moor Park, he found there a little girl of 8, daughter of a merchant named Edward Johnson, who had died young. Swift says that Esther Johnson was born on March 18, 1681, in the parish register of Richmond, 1, which shows that she was baptized on March 20, 1680-81. Her name is given as Hester, but she signed her Wilkes Thur, the name by which she was always known. Swift says, her father was a younger brother of a good family in Nottinghamshire, her mother of a lower degree, and indeed as he had little to boast in her birth. Mrs. Johnson had two children, Esther and Anne, and lived at Moor Park as companion to Lady Gifford, Temple's widowed sister. Another member of the household, afterwards to be Esther's constant companion, was Rebecca Dingley, a relative of the Temple family. Too, she was a year or two older than Swift. The lonely young man of 22 was both playfellow and teacher of the delicate child of 8. How he taught her to write has been charmingly brought before us in the painting exhibited by Miss Dixie at the Royal Academy a few years ago. He advised her what books to read, and instructed her, as he says, in the principles of honor and virtue, from which she never swerved in any one action or moment of her life. By 1694 Swift had grown tired of his position, and finding that Temple, who valued his services, was slow in finding him preferment, he left Moor Park in order to carry out his resolve to go into the church. He was ordained, and obtained the prebend of Kilroot, near Belfast, where he carried on a flirtation with a Miss Waring, whom he called Verena. But in May 1696 Temple made proposals which induced Swift to return to Moor Park, where he was employed in preparing Temple's memoirs and correspondence for publication, and in supporting the side taken by Temple in the Letters of Valorous Controversy, by writing The Battle of the Books, which was, however, not published until 1704. On his return to Temple's house, Swift found his old playmate grown from a sickly child into a girl of 15, in perfect health. She came, he says, to be looked upon as one of the most beautiful, graceful, and agreeable young women in London, only a little too fat. Her hair was blacker than a raven, and every feature of her face in perfection. On his death in January 1699 Temple left a will, 3, dated 1694, directing the payment of £20 each, with half a year's wages, to Bridget Johnson and all my other servants, and leaving a lease of some land in Monastown, County Wicklow, to Esther Johnson, servant to my sister Gifford. By a codicil of February 1698, Temple left £100 to Mr. Jonathan Swift, now living with me. It may be added that by her will of 1722, proved in the following year, Lady Gifford gave £20 to Mrs. Moss, Mrs. Bridget Johnson, who had married Richard Moser Moss, Lady Gifford's steward. The will proceeds. Oh, Mrs. Esther, sick, Johnson, I give £10, with the £100 I put into the exchequer for her life and my own, and declare the £100 to be hers, which I am told is there in my name upon the survivorship, and for which as he has constantly sent over her certificate, and received the interest. I give her besides my two little silver candlesticks. Temple left in Swift's hands the task of publishing his posthumous works, a duty which afterwards led to a quarrel with Lady Gifford and other members of the family. Many years later, Swift told Lord Palmerston that he stopped at Moor Park solely for the benefit of Temple's conversation and advice, and the opportunity of pursuing his studies. At Temple's death, he was as far to seek as ever. In the summer of 1699, however, he was offered and accepted the post of secretary and chaplain to the Earl of Berkeley, one of the Lord's justices, but when he reached Ireland, he found that the secretaryship had been given to another. He soon, however, obtained the living of Larriker, Ayr, Andruth Beggan, and the prebend of Dunlevin in St. Patrick's Cathedral, Dublin. The total value of these preferments was about £230 a year, an income which Miss Waring seems to have thought enough to justify him in marrying. Swift's reply to the lady whom he had singled out at first from the rest of women could only have been written with the intention of breaking off the connection, and accordingly we hear no more of poor Verena. At Larriker, a mile or two from Trim, and 20 miles from Dublin, Swift ministered to a congregation of about 15 persons, and had abundant leisure for cultivating his garden, making a canal after the Dutch fashion of Moor Park, planting willows, and rebuilding the vicarage. As chaplain to Lord Berkeley, he spent much of his time in Dublin. He was on intimate terms with Lady Berkeley and her daughters, one of whom is best known by her married name of Lady Betty Germain, and through them, he had access to the fashionable society of Dublin. When Lord Berkeley returned to England in April 1701, Swift, after taking his doctor's degree at Dublin, went with him, and soon afterwards published, anonymously, a political pamphlet, a discourse on the contests and dissensions in Athens and Rome. When he returned to Ireland in September, he was accompanied by Stella to give Esther Johnson the name by which she is best known and her friend Mrs. Dingley. Stella's fortune was about £1,500, and the property Temple had left her was in County Wicklow. Swift, very much for his WN satisfaction, who had few friends or acquaintance in Ireland, persuaded Stella, now 20 years old, that living was cheaper there than in England, and that a better return was obtainable on money. The ladies took his advice, and made Ireland their home. At first they felt themselves strangers in Dublin. The adventure looked so like a frolic, Swift says, the censure held for some time, as if there were a secret history in such a removal, which however soon blew off by her excellent conduct. Swift took every step that was possible to avoid scandal. When he was away, the ladies occupied his rooms. When he returned, they went into their own lodgings. When he was absent, they often stopped at the vicarage at Larriker, but if he were there, they moved to Trim, where they visited the vicar, Dr. Raymond, or lived in lodgings in the town or neighborhood. Swift was never with Stella except in the presence of a third person, and in 1726 he said that he had not seen her in a morning piece dozen years, except once or twice in a journey. During a visit to England in the winter of 1703-4, we find Swift in correspondence with the Rev. William Tisdall, a Dublin incumbent whom he had formerly known at Belfast. Tisdall was on friendly terms with Stella and Mrs. Dingley, and Swift sent messages to them through him. Ray put them upon reading, he wrote, and be always teaching something to Mrs. Johnson, because she is good at comprehending, remembering, and retaining. But the correspondence soon took a different turn. Tisdall paid his addresses to Stella, and charged Swift with opposing his suit. Tisdall's letters are missing, but Swift's reply of April 2017-04 puts things sufficiently clearly. My conjecture is, he says, that you think I obstructed your inclinations to please my own, and that my intentions were the same with yours. An answer to all which I will, upon my conscience and honor, tell you the naked truth. First, I think I have said to you before that, if my fortunes and humor served me to think of that state, I should certainly, among all persons upon earth, make your choice, because I never saw that person whose conversation I entirely valued but hers. This was the utmost I ever gave way to. And secondly, I must assure you sincerely, that this regard of mine never once entered into my head, to be an impediment to you. He had thought Tisdall not rich enough to marry, but the objection of your fortune being removed, I declare I have no other, nor shall any consideration of my own misfortune, in losing so good a friend and companion as her, prevail on me, against her interest, and settlement in the world, since it is held so necessary, and convenient a thing for ladies to marry, and that time takes off from the luster of virgins in all other eyes but mine. I appeal to my letters to herself, whether I was your friend or not in the whole concern, though the part I designed to act in it was purely passive. He had even thought tea could not be decently broken, without disadvantage to the lady's credit, since he supposed it was known to the town, and he had always spoken of her in a manner far from discouraging. Though he knew many ladies of rank, he had nowhere met with an humor, a wit, or conversation so agreeable, a better portion of good sense, or a truer judgment of men or things. He envied Tisdall his prudence and temper, and love of peace and settlement, the reverse of which has been the great uneasiness of my life, and is likely to continue so. This letter has been quoted at some length, because of its great importance. It is obviously capable of various interpretations, and some, like Dr. Johnson, have concluded that Swift was resolved to keep Stella in his power, and therefore prevented an advantageous match by making unreasonable demands. I cannot see any ground for this interpretation, though it is probable that Tisdall's appearance as a suitor was sufficiently annoying. There is no evidence that Stella viewed Tisdall's proposal with any favor, unless it can be held to be furnished by Swift's belief that the town thought rightly or wrongly that there was an engagement. In any case, there could be no mistaken future with regard to Swift's attitude towards Stella. She was dearer to him than anyone else, and his feeling for her would not change, but for marriage he had neither fortune nor humor. Tisdall consoled himself by marrying another lady 2 years afterwards, and though for a long time Swift entertained for him feelings of dislike, in later life their relations improved, and Tisdall was one of the witnesses to Swift's will. The Tale of a Tub was published in 1704, and Swift was soon in constant intercourse with Addison and the other wits. While he was in England in 1705, Stella and Mrs. Dingley made a short visit to London. This and a similar visit in 1708 are the only occasions on which Stella is known to have left Ireland, after taking up her residence in that country. Swift's influence over women was always very striking. Most of the toasts of the day were his friends, and he insisted that any lady of wit and quality who desired his acquaintance should make the first advances. This, he says, writing in 1730, had been an established rule for over 20 years. In 1708 a dispute on this question with one toast, Mrs. Long, was referred for settlement to Ginkle van Omri, the son of the house where it was proposed that the meeting should take place. and by the decision which was in Swift's favor, Mrs. Van Amry and her fair daughter Essie were forbidden to aid Mrs. Long in her disobedience for the future. This is the first that we hear of Esther or Esther Van Amry, who was afterwards to play so marked a part in the story of Swift's life. Born on February 14, 1690, she was now 18. Her father, Bartholomew Van Amry, a Dublin merchant of Dutch origin, had died in 1703, leaving his wife a fortune of some £16,000. On the income from this money, Mrs. Van Amry, with her two daughters, Esther and Mary, were able to mix in fashionable society in London. Swift was introduced to them by Sir Andrew Fountain early in 1708, but evidently Stella did not make their acquaintance, nor indeed hear much, if anything, of them until the time of the journal. Swift's visit to London in 1707-9 had for its object the obtaining for the Irish Church of the surrender by the Crown of the First Fruits and Twentieths, which brought in about £2,500 a year. Nothing came of Swift's interviews with the Whig statesmen, and after many disappointments he returned to Lerwicker, June 1709, and conversed with none but Stella and her card-playing friends, and Addison, now secretary to Lord Wharton. For next year came the fall of the Whigs, and a request to Swift from the Irish bishops that he would renew the application for the first fruits, in the hope that there would be greater success with the Tories. Swift reached London in September 1710, and began the series of letters, giving details of the events of each day, which now form the journal to Stella. "We'll write something every day to M.D., he says, "and make it a sort of journal, and when it is full I will send it, whether M.D. writes or no, and so that will be pretty, and I shall always be in conversation with M.D., and M.D. with Presto." It is interesting to note that by way of caution these letters were usually addressed to Mrs. Dingley, and not to Stella. The story of Swift's growing intimacy with the Tory leaders, of the success of his mission, of the increasing coolness towards older acquaintances, and of his services to the government, can best be read in the journal itself. In the meantime, the intimacy with the Van Amrys grew rapidly. They were near neighbors of Swift's, and in a few weeks after his arrival in town we find frequent allusions to the dinners at their house where he kept his best gown and periwig, sometimes with the explanation that he went there out of mere listlessness, or because it was wet, or because another engagement had broken down. Only thrice does he mention the eldest daughter. Once on her Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.